This is the DTV Digest, the podcast that brings you news and reviews of films which didn't make it to the cinema. And now, here's your host, Mike Parkin.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the DTV Digest, the podcast which brings you reviews of films which didn't make it to the cinema and instead went straight to DVD, Blu-ray, and streaming media. I'm your host, Mike Parkin, and joining me via Skype is Richard Hawes.
Hello, everybody.
This week, we're going all out in horror, starting with three new releases. We have Reborn, The Final Wish, and We Summon the Darkness. Our short shot is The Chilling MJ, and our DTV throwback is The Pit, also known as Jugface. So, without any further ado, let's crack on. Our first review, then, is Reborn. A stillborn baby is struck by an electric charge in the morgue and is abducted by the morgue's technician, who keeps her locked in his home. On her 16th birthday, she manages to escape to search for her real mother and is willing to kill anyone who gets in her way. Meanwhile, her Earth mother, a once famous actress called Lena O'Neill, is having nightmares about the night her daughter died and starts to search for her grave in order to get some closure. This stars the likes of Barbara Crampton and Michael Paré, two DTV stalwarts these days. Very welcome to see both of them in meaty roles for once. I really enjoyed this one, Rich. It kicks off with that scene in the morgue, and you're not sure which way it's going to go. And then all of a sudden, the morgue's, you know, this technician guy is taking photos of the dead bodies for his own use, shall we say? Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, you think, okay, here comes the sleaze factor. And then it sort of kicks off from there, and I was pleasantly surprised by it.
Yeah, there's a lot of focus on Barbara Crampton's character, which, you see her name in the cast, and you expect it's just going to be a quick cameo. But it's very much a... There's two leads in this movie, which is Barbara Crampton's character and her young actress, whose name I can't remember, playing the daughter, who's the reanimated baby, all grown up and looking for said mother. The story moves between the two of them, which I quite like because, you know, you often focus on... different kinds of characters. I don't think you would normally focus on a character like Barbara Crampton's. So I thought that was good for her. Mm-hmm. And also you get Michael Paré as the police officer sort of investigating, you know, all the sort of strange, suspicious deaths that are going on around this lady. And so he gets quite a lot to do as well in a kind of a sort almost of Sam Loon, this kind of role in the story.
It was one of his better roles that I've seen him in for a while, I thought. He does really well in it.
Yeah, and the film itself is quite... I think you can visibly see the sort of budget straining at times, especially with the visual effects and that. But I thought they did a really good job. Ray Dawn Chong is in there.
I was going to mention, yeah.
I really liked her death scene. I thought that was really... It's a very familiar... jump scare kind of moment that we see all too often, as we'll evidence in this episode. But for me, that was a really good example of it. It just completely took me by surprise.
Absolutely, same here. That's the one I said where it actually did make me jump.
I went, jeez! And usually you see that bit and it's just like, yeah, okay, you know, you can see it coming, and in this case, you just couldn't. And it was nicely done as well, because the whole idea of the concept of the girl is, she's not just reanimated, but she's also got like psychokinetic powers over electricity. And so in that instance, she is controlling the vehicle, which I thought was a nice sort of touch. Usually, you know, they're sort of reaching out. It's not just, you know, starting a fire or pylons or things. They're just sort of going into other areas of electricity.
Yeah, which is nice, you know, because... I was a bit worried it's going to end up like Wes Craven's Shocker or something along those sort of lines, you know, but it did sort of put a bit of spin on it. And what I also liked was, the fact that her character, Tess, is actually very sympathetic.
Yes.
You know, she's had this, you know, this very tragic upbringing, which is sort of, you know, put her in this sort of mindset, I guess, you know, sort of where the whole world's out to get her and everything. And, you know, she has to kill people to get what she wants. But
The sort of, she was taken home by the creepy guy, and there, it sort of treads around, you know, what her growing up was like. You kind of get the impression, you know, you initially think that he would be a father, like a very sort of abusive father figure, but he is clearly, you know, twisted and perhaps a bit abusive to her, but they don't sort of go into that too much. And he says, "I'm not your brother," or some point, or whatever. So that seemed to me a sort of a deliberate sidestepping that didn't really fit. I think his natural fit was to be the sort of to be the one raising her in whatever way he was. So I don't know what quite happened there.
Well, the thing is, the other thing is that you get the impression that he was. Is very much like Norman Bates in Psycho. You know, he's very much a mother's boy. You know, the fact that his mum's corpse is still in her room and never been moved. You know, when Michael Parry first turns up to the house, they say there's two bodies. What one's the mortician, and the other's his mother, who's like a decomposed corpse and still in bed.
Right.
So, you know, you get the impression that she was, you know, it was a very matriarchal family. And even in death, she still sort of held sway over him.
That's interesting. Yeah, I think you could be onto something there, because there's a lot of touchstones in this film, and that's probably one of the more subtle ones. I think, say, Psycho, they're leaning in heavily on, you know, Firestarter and Carrie, which they even, I think, mention on the cover art for the movie. It knows what it is. You know, it's treading a familiar path. I quite like it had more of the feeling of a 90s Psycho thriller, though. You know, back when we had like Hand Rocks the Cradle with that, it was a psycho nanny or a psycho secretary or a psycho ex-wife. You know, there was this whole slew of DTVers that were coming out about the psycho this and psycho that, and this is like a psycho estranged daughter with a supernatural element added onto it. So it covers it mixes quite a lot in there, and it's got a very brisk running time. I think it was only about an hour and 12 minutes long.
But I mean, what I also liked about it was the fact that, you know, sort of Lena O'Neill, Barbara Crampton's character, was pretty much oblivious to everything that was actually going on. You know, she had her own sort of story arc all the way through.
Yeah.
You know, the fact that she'd been having these bad dreams, and, you know, when she sees a psychiatrist, they suggest, you know, getting closure by finally visiting a daughter's grave, and then finding out that there isn't a grave, you know, and all that sort of stuff. And then, you know, it's actually Michael Parry's character who's sort of putting two and two together all the way through.
Which is
a nice twist to it.
Yeah, the whole film unfortunately hinges on a really massive coincidence, which was just too laughable, really. It's like the mother and the daughter literally both turning up at the hospital on the same day. After 16 years.
that's kind of the point, though, wasn't it? Because it was her 16th birthday. So, you know, that's how she got out, was because she was insisting that she sees her birth mother.
Well, but not the mother, though. It just happened to be that her psychiatrist told her on that day to go and explore it or whatever. There's a couple of, you know, some of the nods and, you know, tips of the hat, whatever, are a bit too on the nose. They went full on Carrie right at the end. I just thought that was a step too far, personally. Although there is a really unusual development to that, because you kind of start to wonder it's one of those endings that you don't actually. It's more than you wonder what it means. You know, it's almost like a. So did this all just happen, or was it part of her mental process as an actress or something? Or I might be reading too much into it, but
is it her method, sort of thing?
Yeah, is it her method? There's a, you know, there's the Carrie bit and the sort of the dream kind of thing, but then this ties in with her story of her trying to reclaim her career as a as an actress, and as a cameo by a very well-known director, which was quite nice as well.
Peter Bogdanovich,
yeah, of the Last Picture Show and stuff. So that was I because they kept mentioning him, and then I was like, I was really surprised when we saw someone at the end, and I was, is that him? And check the credit. No, no, it is actually him. Apparently, he's acted in quite a lot of stuff, which I didn't realise.
The other thing I liked about this is, obviously her powers had manifested themselves before her 16th birthday, which is why they made sort of stepmother and stepbrother making her wear that sort of metal bracelet.
I wasn't sure what all that was about.
Yeah. That's the impression I got. It was that they were aware of her powers and that's there as a sort of painful reminder. You know, if she tries to conduct electricity, you can end up burning herself.
Uh-huh.
So, which is why it was the first thing she got rid of.
Oh, that makes sense. Yeah, there are some, I think, as you mentioned with the psychic thing, there's these nice little touches in there that are not sort of overdone, and they can easily, they went over my head. So it's quite actually well put together film, really, isn't it?
It was a pleasant surprise, that's for sure. I really enjoyed watching it.
It's made by Julian Richards, who's made at least one or two films in the past that I really enjoyed. One of them was The Last Horror Movie.
Oh, yeah.
Which was it starts out like a movie and then it turns into a man bites dog, whatever kind of documentary following a serial killer around. Mm. That was really good. He's a British filmmaker, I believe.
So,
I'm just trying to think of any other films he's done, but he's been around for quite a while. So he's very experienced.
Sure.
So, yeah. What do you rate this one then?
This is a very solid 7 out of 10.
Mm-hmm. I'm gonna go 6, I think, on this one.
Mm-hmm. Cool. So that's a 7 and a 6 for Reborn. Our next review is The Final Wish. Country boy turned lawyer Aaron Hammond is shocked to hear that his father has died and makes the trip home to a rather frosty reception from both his mother, his neighbour, and his dog. And his ex-girlfriend. Among his father's possessions, he finds an antique urn, which he soon comes to realize is able to grant him wishes, but at a price. Dun, dun, dun. Cue the monkey's paw.
Yeah, exactly.
What I quite liked about this is that the first couple of wishes are pretty innocuous and don't realize they've been granted.
Yes.
And I was wondering if he's going to go through the whole film without ever realizing what was going on, which would have made a very interesting film, if he just remains completely oblivious to what the cause is behind everything.
Yeah, it was around the time of the accident, the one there, I thought was quite clever, I thought.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, that was pretty smart, actually. And again, it's like we were saying in our previous review, the whole very, very shocking sort of incident, which you're not expecting. There's no sort of build up or anything to it. It's just bam. But it comes after he says, "I wish I had a better face or something along."
Yeah. I wish I was better looking.
That's it. Yeah, I wish I was better looking, which was quite cool. He's a very interesting character, as Aaron. Probably not somebody you want to know particularly. He's one of these sort of lovable losers, and the sort of loser bit is more or less his own doing. He's been big upping his career back home, saying, I'm making partner next year, all this sort of stuff. When in fact, he's still struggling to get a job with a law firm. He sort of skipped town, doesn't want to go back, but he's sort of dragged back because of his father's death, and having to sort of confront a few home truths. Lynn Shay plays his mum, a really good performance from her. I mean, if you've seen the Insidious films, you know what a great presence she usually is anyway, but she's given quite a bit of range to play here because, she's not only grieving, but also possessed and all the rest of it. It's really good. There's a one freaky bit where Aaron wishes that she's happy, wishes she was more happy. And of course she's forced to be happy, forced to smile, forced to laugh. And it's a great performance because she's trying to break out of it. This is really, really cool. So yeah. And there's some, a few sort of surprises along the way.
Yeah. Like the previous film, we've got the, sort of cult actors being cast. So we've got Barbara Crampton was in Reborn with her legacy of work. And this one, we've got Lynn Shay, who's probably even more, so it's more about what she's currently doing is making her like one of the go-to horror. Because like you say, with the Insidious film, which I haven't seen, but she's been around, you know, in horror movies since the 80s herself, being turning up in things like Nightmare on Elm Street and that. But so she, yeah, absolutely, she brings a lot to the film in that supporting role. And we've also got Tony Todd doing one of his obligatory one scene cameo. He basically does the same thing he did in Final Destination, which is be the guy who they go to and
Mr. Exposition.
Yeah, which so you get the first part of the film out of the way, and then as you get towards sort of you get into the middle section, it becomes the hero and a girl investigating, trying to figure out what's going on. And so they go and interview someone who then tells them some information, and then they go and through, you get the going to the asylum to visit the person who was last driven mad by this kind of thing. I just thought that was hilarious, because that's so familiar. How many times? I mean, one of the ones I think of, I think is like, I think White Noise 2, The Light, with Nathan Fillion. I think that had one of those in, and probably Peter Boyle in like Species 2 or something. I don't know. Yeah. There's loads of that sort of stuff. But so that sort of become a bit laughable for me at that stage. But by the time it got to the end, I was actually sort of quite on board with the twists and turns of what is a very familiar Monkey's Paw variation, you know, like an extended Twilight Zone. Basically,
that final wish bit, it's almost like he was Homer Simpson, you know, because he gets tricked into it so easily. It is really funny the way that was set up.
Yeah, I agree.
It just falls for it so easily. There's somebody I do want to give a shout out to, and that is Melissa Bologna, who plays Lisa, the ex-girlfriend who's now married to Eric, whatever his name is.
Derek,
actually, yeah. I actually managed to interview her a few years back.
Because
she was in The Neighbour.
Yes, okay, yeah.
And she was in that. It's really good to see her in something again recently.
Is that The Neighbour or The Collector?
No, The Neighbour.
Yeah, The Neighbour. Nice.
Yeah.
Which one's The Neighbour? Sorry.
It's about the drug runners who live next door to a kidnapping ring.
Right,
recognizing it.
Yes. Sorry. Was that from the same makers as The Collector?
It was, yeah.
Yeah, that's why I get the two confused. Yeah, but I know exactly the film you're talking about. I do remember seeing it. Yeah.
She was the kidnap victim.
Right, okay. Yeah.
But not really a lot more to say about this without sort of giving too much away, but it is very well shot.
It's a good looking film.
I thought it was a bit sort of slow to begin with. Found myself sort of a bit distracted to begin with, but other than that, I thought it was a very solid film.
When they do the thing and he becomes more good looking, did you actually get anything from that? Because I was just thinking, you look exactly the same.
I think you had a bit more foundation on.
Did you? Because everyone was like, oh.
I think that's all you need, really, isn't it? You need the reaction more than anything else.
Yeah.
Going, oh, my beautiful boy, and all that. Yeah.
This was directed by Timothy Woodruff Jr.
Now,
Woodruff Jr. Did he do American Violence?
Yes, he. Well, he produced. Yes, he did.
Yeah, he did, because he's done quite a lot of movies, and most, I think.
Hang on, we reviewed that one, didn't we?
Yeah, we did. Yeah.
That's the one with the guy in prison.
That's the one we really didn't like it very much.
Didn't like it.
No, but this was, I think, very, decent, sort of 90s era, sort of, 90s, 2000s horror, glossy, decent production values. Yeah, I thought it was absolutely fine. But, really passed, 90 minutes long, passed the time very nicely, put me in the mood to watch a lot more horror movies, to be honest.
Well, it was just as well, really, wasn't it? Mm. Yeah, no, it was. It was a very solid little film, certainly better than some of the things we've seen recently. This also, like Reborn, this gets a solid 7 from me.
and I'll give it a 6 again.
Very conservative this week.
I am. He's quite conservative.
Our next review is We Summon the Darkness. It's 1988, and deep in America's Bible Belt, the local community is struck by a spate of murders by a satanic cult. When three rock chicks head out to a metal concert and meet up with three boys in a van, it's the start of a shocking, gruesome evening for all of them. Now, there's not a lot we can talk about the plot here, Rich, really, because we want to keep our powder dry and we don't want to spoil things for everyone. This is a very inventive, very, very smart, very interesting film. I was thoroughly entertained by this. How about you?
Yeah, I enjoyed this a lot. Very good production values. The film spends a lot of time setting up its characters. So it's kind of a bit of a slow burn at first. It takes quite a while to get going, but that's because you're being drawn in and familiarizing yourself with the core characters. There's the three young ladies who are our principal leads, and then there's three guys who they meet later, and the six of them are the sort of the main characters for the rest of the story as it unfolds. As you say, twists in the tale, so we can't really say too much, but suffice to say the things are not as they appear, and there's some quite interesting developments in what is essentially a variation on the Manson family kind of situation. Very sort of almost not quite, not satirical, that's not what they got. A twisted twist on what you expect from this kind of setup. I will go into just sort of touching on a couple of the characters, but not really. There's one of the main characters, called Valerie, and I found it quite hard to understand the motivations for some of her actions in the story, so that was kind of a bit of a takeaway. But I thought they were really good. The whole cast was great, very relatable, kind of identifiable sort of characters. The lead young lady, I wish I could remember the names of. My computer's so slow, I can't actually get IMDb.
Amy Forsyth was Beverly. Maddie Hassan was Val. And Alexandra Daddario was Alexis. So there were the three female leads. Then you had Mark, who's the drummer who's leaving for New York or somewhere.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you had his two friends. What was it, Ivan and Kovacs were the other two, like Logan Miller.
Yeah, and we've got a couple of other characters. We've also got Johnny Knoxville in there a little bit as well. He's really good because he was like quite against... Tight.
Yeah, and I was surprised because, you know, because they sort of held him back so long in the story. Early on, we see him just on the TV in the background because he plays like an evangelical, you know, preacher with his TV show and all that sort of stuff. And I thought, is that it? Is it going to be like Dolph Lundgren in Welcome to Willits? You know. when they do bring him in, the way they shoot him, you know, with the camera, they keep the camera really low as he's sort of walking through the house. It's really, really interesting.
Yeah, so there's a lot. I mean, the soundtrack is also quite good. You've got it's all set around the heavy metal era. So, I mean, I don't know metal. I mean, I like metal, but I don't know it, you know, it's like in the period. But I should have. If all the references that they're talking are like the real deal, I think people who are into the music are going to get a lot out of it because they seem to know what they're talking about.
Yeah.
There is a bit where they play "Heaven Is a Place on Earth," but it's a dodgy cover version, which didn't quite fit. I guess because it would have cost too much to get the real version, which was Belinda Carlisle, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was.
The original. Yeah.
I'm pretty sure it really was to power over the end credits with Heart.
That was to power. Yeah.
I played the whole credits just to hear that song. It's my era, folks.
Yeah, the ending's quite twisted as well. You know, it's not the, you know, kind of ending.
It's nice that, you know, the way that the rug gets pulled out of from out the feet of everyone at the end. It's a good sort of like twist. So yeah, this is very solid. We do recommend. I certainly recommend it. I'm sure Rich recommends it.
I do too. Yes.
It's interesting. It's got a great sort of the way it develops is really, really interesting. So definitely check this one out. We think so. I'm gonna go as far as I'm gonna push it up to an 8. Believe it or not.
And I am gonna go. I was gonna go 7, but what the hell? I'm gonna go 8 as well.
Wow, broken them down at last. Yes, 2 8s for We Summon the Darkness is our recommendation of the week. Our short shot this week is MJ. Mary Jane is a young woman working for a PR firm who gets fed up with the emptiness of her life and the lives of people around her and decides to do something about it. So this is about 13 minutes long, Rich. Young girl called Mary Jane. And, you know, to a certain degree, I'm an old crusty guy, you know, but I know what it's like with phones and mobiles and the way they take over your lives. And I did feel for a bit when she's on this sort of date that she hooked up with a guy on a certain app where you swipe left or right. And he spends the whole time on his fucking phone, you know. I'm not surprised that things sort of like developed from there. What do you make of this one?
Yeah, I thought it was well observed. I think completely accidentally, it sort of ties in with themes on a couple of the films we've watched. So thinking like Reborn, for example, you know, it's a young woman, girl really, who's, you know, quite vulnerable, you know, quite isolated, and, you know, things sort of get out of control. And the same thing seems to happen here. I mean, we don't really know this character very well. Mm. We're not quite sure how things develop. You know, is this when we see them? So basically she gets quite violent in this story. We're not sure if this is like the first time she's done it or whether it's been going on for a while. There's not a lot of explanation. It's much more of a cold sort of observing kind of take on it. I thought it was really good. Very strong sort of, very strong performance from the lead actress who playing MJ. She, you know, she doesn't say a lot. She doesn't have anyone to say it to.
There was that sort of brief conversation she has with the girl with the short hair in the toilets. You know, and she goes, oh, like, you know, this girl says, oh, I liked your photo on Instagram or something. And then she doesn't bother hanging around for a response, you know. It's a very old adage, isn't it, where they say the easiest, you know, the quickest way to get away from someone you don't like is to sort of barely engage in a conversation and then shut it down as quickly as possible sort of thing. You know, and that's the way she sort of treats her a little bit. But it's, everyone in this, you know, everyone's obsessed with their phones, with Instagram. You know, she takes thousands of pictures and she's cropping them and all the rest of it before she puts them on Instagram. You know, very image conscious. The people she works with are very image conscious. It's kind of like, it's almost like a pureed version of American Psycho. It sort of goes in that way, and it's for the first half of the film I'm sort of waiting for the other shoe to drop a little bit, because the way it's filmed, you know, when she's out on the street, you know, the camera's catching other people around her and you don't know if they're going to approach her or what. You know, make cat calls and things like that. There's other people, you know, when she's sitting down having something to eat and people are looking at her and you don't know, oh god, what's going to happen sort of thing. But it's a very it's a very edgy film, I found.
Yeah, and I think your American Psycho observation is very good there. The story it doesn't go in the same direction in terms of its conclusion, but it could easily well have done. I mean, you know, it's all, you know, the psychology of the character and the way she's expressing herself. I mean, in this case, the theme of the film is like social media and it is the need for attention and but not really drawing you together and all that kind of stuff. And there's very, you know, it's all very current. I think this was made in about 2018 and, you know, just sort of just recently released, I think on YouTube, or I think it's YouTube. And yeah, you know, we're seeing a lot of horror movies tackling social media and its impact on behavior and, you know, things. And some of it's, you know, bringing in ghosts or whatever and that sort of stuff. But this is real. You know, this is this is a real situation and a very sort of relatable, almost quite sympathetic in a way, character.
Because even, you know, when she's in the office and people like, but you know, because she's posted pictures of sort of, you know, the murders on her Instagram and or wherever. And people going, oh, it's not real. You know, it looks real, but it's not real. And people going, no, it's real. And you know, it's generating that kind of buzz that, you know, they expect. But, I mean, what sort of fucking job do they do, man? Because they just hang around the office and just, like, practice dance moves and stuff.
Yeah, I got the idea that they were probably working in something like PR.
Because she's cutting out pictures of from magazines and stuff to sort of, you know, put together presentations and stuff like that. So yeah, it's that sort of thing. But yeah, sort of people with their finger on the pulse of the zeitgeist and all that. And, you know.
One of the other things I really liked was there's she has an exchange with the guy, I think, who's the one she ends up going for a date with, and she co-ops his lines.
Yeah.
So when she makes the next conversation.
Yeah.
She uses what was said to her.
Yeah, exactly.
So she's
it's
leading.
Almost like the Terminator, isn't it? You know?
Yeah, I thought it was very, very well put together. I watched, when we were preparing this episode, I watched quite a number of horror shorts, and this was sort of head and shoulders above the rest. You know, even though it's not particularly horrific, just in terms of the characterization and the sort of narrative momentum that it has, I think it's well worth a look.
Definitely, yeah. So this is on YouTube. We'll put the link in the footnotes like we usually do with the shorts. It's 30 minutes long. Not too horrible. So everyone's stuck at home these days. So I was going to say not very safe. Maybe safe for work. Who knows? But definitely check it out. Our DTV throwback this week is Jugface, also known as The Pit. Long ago, a backwoods community made a pact with a demonic creature which lives in a pit. In exchange for keeping the people healthy, the demon will occasionally demand a sacrifice, and to ensure impartiality, the local potter is possessed by the demon, who then makes a clay jug without his realizing, with the likeness of the sacrifice carved into it. Now, when a young girl called Ada discovers that her face has been carved into one of the jugs, she hides the jug out of fear, but this only unleashes a worse fate for her and her community. Now, I've seen this one before, Rich. This is one of the few that I had actually seen before in the DTV throwback section. I really did like it when I first saw it. I really dug the sort of backwoods culture that the film sort of portrays. I think it does a good job of sort of building this sort of community. And especially enjoyed the opening credit sequence, which basically tells the story that I've sort of just outlined.
Yeah. Yes, it's very good. The film, what you've explained there is more than the film really explains itself, because it's kind of, a lot of it goes without, there's not really much exposition at all.
It's all in the credits. You just got to pay attention to the opening animation, because it starts off with you know, these pilgrims sort of, you know, setting up a community sort of way back when, and you got the local priest who sort of like saying, well, if you pray to God, you won't get sick or whatever. And of course, people are getting sick and dying despite the fact they're praying. And then they discover this you know, this pit, and they make a pact with the guy in the pit. And the first person they sacrifice is the priest, which I thought was really funny, actually. But it's all just in this sort of, you know, short animation sequence at the beginning.
Yeah, and I took it in a slightly different way, of that the community believed that this was that they were a Christian community, and they believed that they found this thing that was of God, And then the preacher being, or the priest, sorry, being selected as the sacrifice, being that pivotal turning moment, because, you know, the priest is there or whatever, but the rest of the, there's no talk of God or anything in this film. They only talk of the pit. That's all they say, which is quite interesting because the film itself has the title on the film is Jugface, which is a very unusual, you know, bit you sort can, of left
imagine,
field.
Yeah, you can see why it was changed for the UK market, basically.
They've changed it to The Pit, which is much more commercial and, you know, and acceptable. But it is also what they call it. They call it The Pit in the film. So it's very apt. So both titles work. But the original title really hints at what sort of indie kind of movie this is. This is folk horror, basically. Sort of a cult, so tribal kind of community. They're also living in, you know, motorhomes and that out in the woods, and they're sort of away from the town. They do go into town, but they are living apart from it, basically living on money from selling moonshine
to hipsters.
Yeah. And after that opening, you know, there's a lot of weird stuff in the movie, but it isn't overtly weird. It's quite straightforward in its narrative. It doesn't explain everything. You know, there's the whole thing about the jugs with people's faces on is, you know, very random, very sort of unusual. The pit itself is not explained. It's very, you know, you see it bubbling occasionally, but, you know, that's all there is. The community characters are really what it's built around, and this includes Larry Fessenden, who's perfectly cast.
He's brilliant in this. He's almost like a sort of like a fat Jack Nicholson almost, isn't he?
But you've also got Sean Young, who's terribly cast.
You think so? I don't know.
She's not good in this at all.
I actually really liked her performance in this because she's this sort of, you know, very strong-willed sort of matriarchal character. Yeah. You know. And, you know, there's a very sort of, it's not a misogynistic approach to sort of womanhood, but it is, you know, an ingrained belief that, you know, women are there to rear children or bear children. And there's a great line by Larry Fessenden's character where he's telling his daughter, saying, you know, men can't make babies. It's only the women that can do this. You know, that's what makes you special. And, you know, it's almost sort of reverential the way he says it, you know, which I thought was really interesting. But, you know, poor old Ada is stuck between a rock and a hard place because she's been having an incestuous affair with her older brother.
Yeah, that's weird.
That's pretty fucking, you know, almost, you know, you could say it's like stereotypical of sort of, you know, the way these sort of communities are portrayed. But he, you know, he's a bit of a shit, basically, because as soon as he finds out that she's to be wed to some other guy, you know, he wants nothing to do with her and he's threatening her to, you know, to keep her mouth shut and all this. And then it turns out that he's got her pregnant as well, you know, which just makes things even worse. And then she finds out that she's, you know, she's supposed to be the next sacrificial lamb for the pit, which is where things really get bad for her, basically. Yeah.
She messes it all up, basically. She causes all the trouble. Yeah. And she's not particularly, she is kind of sympathetic, but, you know, when you realize that, you know, she's just, it's her, she's done, she knows what, you know, the situation is, and she's putting herself above everyone and gets, you know, people are getting, you know, the wrath of the pit, which is done in a, this isn't a big special effects-y kind of movie. The sort of supernatural visuals and stuff are quite low budget, and more of the swirl the camera around with a bit of
It's a bit alien,
yeah. But that doesn't matter. That's not what the film is about. The film is about the characters, which
it's,
I think
it's quite visceral. Still, there's, you know, you still see quite a few entrails and things.
You do, yeah.
And the other interesting aspect is that she's forced to experience each kill as well. You know, so it's like, this is what you've done. You know, you have to sort of endure it as well. So I mean, she only sort of comes to her senses when her friend Dwight, who's the potter, is starting to be threatened as well. She sort of tries to put things right.
He's a great performance as well.
Yeah, he is. Yeah, really enjoyed him in this. So yeah, this is it's on Amazon. It's one of those sort of overlooked films. He probably went, don't know.
No, I appreciate you pointing it out to me because I would have I've never heard of it. I think it's from 2014.
I think so. Yeah,
something like that. And it's been around for a few years, but I'd never come across it. And I think it's great. I think anybody, I've recommended a friend of mine who's I know he's into like The Wicker Man and stuff. I think he'd really get a kick out of it.
It is, yeah. I love that sort of thing. I think I've said before, the idea of like people having to do bad things for the greater good, and you might sort of question it, thinking, "Oh no, that's a bad thing." Yeah, but if I don't do it, it's going to be even worse, which is the whole Wicker Man thing and many others like the Rites of Spring and things like that. So I thoroughly recommend it. We don't score the throwbacks, as but this is on Amazon Prime, and if you haven't seen it, check it out. It's a really interesting film about folk horror. And that's the end of this particular episode. Thank you for listening. Thank you for Rich for delving into all these nice little, very different sort of horror films that we've been able to look at this week.
Yeah, a very good selection, I think.
Very good indeed. In our next episode, hopefully we're going to have a bit of Hemsworth to deal with. Looking forward to talking about that one. You know what I'm talking about. So tune in again next time. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening to the DTV Digest. Let us know your thoughts in the comments and tune in again next time.